From Duval, Washington, it's the 407 Cast. Here's your host, RSD Superintendent, Dr. Susan Leach.
Hello, and welcome to the 407 Cast, your window into the dynamic world of education in the Riverview School District, where we discuss our achievements, the challenges we face, and the innovative ways we are accelerating learning, and we're excited you chose to listen in. Hello, I am excited to announce this week's guest, Ms. Kristen Edlund, Assistant Director of the Teaching and Learning Department here in the district. Welcome, Kristen.
Thanks, Susan.
I have so many things that I want to ask you about today. I'm not even sure where to start, but maybe what we could do is just start with, what was your career trajectory that led you to this work?
I was mentored into this work by a lot of happy accidents and just really finding a passion for it. I'd started as being trained to teach elementary, but then landed in middle school, which I loved. In that role, I had one of our district's first instructional coaches and curriculum coaches who was housed out of my library where I was the teacher librarian. And I had a full-time mentor in curriculum development there and somebody to watch me teach all the time. And so that just really made me passionate about mentoring and supporting teachers in their growth. I got to work with the amazing Nancy Skerritt in Tahoma. I think a lot of people in our district are familiar with her work, and she really mentored me in curriculum development as well. And then eventually shifted from the classroom into a support role in the district office, working with new teacher support, leadership development, and curriculum development, instructional practice in Tahoma. And then from there, wanted to experience a larger district and went to Issaquah, where I supported secondary teachers. And that really taught me the importance of systems and processes. But I really was eager to get back to a small district where you're nimble and you can have a little more contact with the students and teachers more directly, and that's what brought me to Riverview.
That's one of my favorite things about the size of this district. This is the first time in my career that I feel like I've been able to develop relationships with building staff, all of the principals. I know students when I walk into buildings, I've never had that. Could you walk us through what you're looking at for curriculum adoption? What curriculum are you looking to adopt? And what is the process for that? Because I'm not sure people understand how much is involved in that important decision.
We are right now in the middle of a curriculum adoption for grades 3 through 5 in social studies and reading, which is a little unusual sometimes to put two content areas together like that. We have one committee working on both of those, but we've done a lot of content integration work over the last couple of years that's been really powerful. And all that means is that we're taking our different content areas that we tend to teach in silos. You know, it's reading time, it's writing time, it's science time, it's social studies time, it's math time. And that's not the way the real world works. We know that when we can connect those content areas and read and write through science, for example, the kids are engaged because they have a really relevant purpose for their reading and writing. And it also gives us effectively a lot more time teaching science or teaching social studies. And science of reading research really shows us how important it is to be building background knowledge for reading comprehension. And the way we do that is by teaching science more and teaching social studies more. So because we're really committed to that integration and we know how important it is for those content areas to support each other, we decided to look at both of those content areas together in this curriculum adoption. Grades K-2 already have a science of reading aligned reading and writing curriculum. They have a really strong experiential social studies curriculum in addition to our very hands-on FOSS science. Our need at grades 3 through 5 was a science of reading aligned curriculum at that level. And our social studies units at the 3 through 5 level were a little more outdated, not as culturally responsive as we would hope. So we brought a committee together of teachers from each school, from each grade level, to look at possibilities in that area. And so what we do when we jump into a curriculum adoption is first we look at what our needs are. And then we also look at what our learning needs are. So with this group, we really looked at a little bit of content integration learning together. We dove into our standards together. That's really the most important thing before looking at any curriculum resources, is to really know what you're trying to do, what you're trying to teach, what standards you're accountable to, what classroom practices, so that you can bring those as a lens to any resources that you might adopt. Because we're going to take those resources, the resource is not the curriculum, the resource is a resource, and we want to have our fidelity be to the standards and our integrity to that curriculum resource, because it's been designed to have an impact if implemented in a certain way. So we want to make sure that we are incorporating the practices that show efficacy, you know, for that curriculum, and not just ignore that. But really, we're adopting a resource versus a curriculum. We create the curriculum by taking the resource, creating a scope and sequence, and bringing our practices to that. In some content areas, like in our secondary math, for example, we spent a lot of time before ever looking at resources, really working with the math practices, working with a consultant from UW who helped our teachers really understand the impact of rich math tasks so that they could really bring that lens to the resources and choose something that had what they were looking for. With this curriculum adoption that we're in the middle of right now with grades 3 through 5, we looked at lots of different social studies resources and lots of ELA, English Language Arts resources. In our district, the job of that committee is to identify a resource to recommend. So right now, they're field testing resources in both those areas. And a field test is kind of like a pilot, but the purpose of a field test is really to uncover any hidden needs or challenges or things to prepare for in order to have a successful implementation. So by the time we get to a field test, the committee's decided that this is what they like the best, what they want to recommend. And they're trying to figure out, how does this actually work in the classroom? Is it as engaging as they thought it would be? What are the hidden needs with it? And then if that field test goes well, they'll recommend those to our instructional materials committee. And that's the committee that has representation from different areas, different levels across the district. They're not necessarily 3 through 5 teachers. They're kind of an unbiased group. It might include parents who will look at those curricula and do an independent evaluation of them, look for bias and things like that. And then if they give it the thumbs up, they'll send that to the school board to make a decision about adoption. One thing that we've shifted with this adoption is that in our system, we've always had a community or parent involvement piece at the end of the process. Mm-hmm. So maybe after IMC gets the curriculum and before it goes to the school board, we have a piece in our school board policy where that curriculum goes on public display. So yeah, we would put it up for display in the district office. We would publicize that and people could come in and take a look and give feedback. But at that point, it's really the end of the process. It's already been selected. It's already been recommended. And so with Dr. Lombardi and your leadership this year, we've really brought parents in at the front end of the process. We've actually invited parents to come and be part of that committee work, sit in with them, have discussions with the committee, look at data with the committee. And that's been a really powerful piece this year. I think our teachers have really enjoyed having that voice. The parents who've come have been really thoughtful and contributed great questions, and we'll continue to invite them to our meetings as we get close to a consensus decision about recommending the curriculum or not. And so that's a shift that we're really excited about. It's going really well.
Thank you you very much for doing that. It's very important. How long will the field testing go? Is it through the end of this school year?
It will have kind of a hard stop near the end of April because in order to have an adoption decision by the school board, we'll need to debrief the field test. We'll need to send a recommendation to IMC. They'll need time to look at the curriculum and do their own review of our process. Then we usually have a school board work study so that they can hear about it and look at it themselves and have another week to consider before it goes to the school board meeting. And so in order to have a timeline where if these materials are adopted, purchase them and have some initial training for folks before the end of the school year so that they're ready to hit the ground running. The social studies, they've been field testing a resource most of this year. With the reading, that's been actually a shorter field test where they are field testing just a couple of units.
From your anecdotal feedback, you feel like both of them are on their way to being recommended?
I think so far, anecdotally, the ELA curriculum, I've only heard positive about. We just sent out our first feedback form, so we collect specific feedback along the way. Those will get collected at the end of this week, so then I'll have a better idea because each person field testing will need to fill that out. So anecdotally, people are pretty excited about it, but those are the only people I've heard from so far. With the social studies, we're looking at a resource called Inquire Ed, and it's a super cool inquiry-based resource. The standards for social studies now are very inquiry-based, meaning instead of teaching kids history and telling them what happened and what to think about it, instead it's about teaching kids to formulate their own questions, plan their own investigations, teaching them critical thinking skills of looking at different points of view, comparing and contrasting, looking at causes and effects, so that kids actually can form their own ideas about what's important to them and what has occurred in our history and how they want to be an active citizen. What do they want to do to improve something that they care about in a way that matters to them? That's a real shift from the way history used to be taught. And this is a really great resource for that. What we're finding out from the field test, this is a really great example of what a field test can do. On paper, everybody was really excited about this. I think people are still really excited about it. However, it's also come to light that this is a very prep-heavy, materials prep-heavy curriculum. Mm-hmm. And it may be that it's really heavy the first time through. Right. And a lot of printing, creation of things that the kids are going to use. Teachers have big file boxes that are full of these things that they've put together. It's a heavy load. Some of them are saying, hey, it's a heavy load, but I've done it now. Now I can continue to use this. Those are the kinds of things that when we really debrief, we'll be able to look at what's kind of the cost benefit on this, what would be our responsibility as a district to support the implementation of this? Is that something we can do? How have the teachers found it? How powerful have they found it? How engaging has it been? And it'll be up to the committee to decide if they want to recommend it.
I think it's all very exciting. I love the direction that you're going in, and I love the process that you're using. So I appreciate you taking the time to explain that. We're hearing more and more over the last few years about OERs. I would love it if you could explain what an OER is and how would you discern the quality of an OER? Are there pitfalls? Are there things to look out for?
Yeah, it's an exciting landscape, actually. OER stands for Open Educational Resource. What that means is that someone has created a curriculum resource that is open for use. So it kind of comes from the language of technology. If you think of open source technology and anybody has access to it and they can modify the source code, right? And they can use that to create their own system. And an OER is similar, even though with OER, there's different rights and attribution, you know, copyright kinds of things. Some are completely open. You can do whatever you want to it with attribution to the original author. Some are more copyrighted and you can't make those changes. What's exciting is that it gives districts a lot more options than these big publishers that have been owning the educational landscape. Some people have the impression that if it's an open resource, it's just sort of a free-for-all. It's teachers pay teachers or something like that. In fact, These curricula are usually funded by big grants from foundations who want to increase access for people who may not have had access to high-quality instructional materials. We know that high-quality instructional materials, you'll see that even abbreviated HQIM sometimes, mm-hmm. are really important for students to have access to rigorous grade-level learning. There are a lot of foundations out there who are committed to education and not wanting students to be dependent on a school district having hundreds of thousands of dollars to spend on an adoption. So they fund the development of these curricula. And in fact, the highest rated math curriculum in the country, illustrative mathematics, began as an OER, and it still is an OER. In the case of IM, you know, now they've licensed that to some of the curriculum companies who then package materials so that you don't have to print them on your own. You can purchase workbooks and things like that through these curriculum companies. The curriculum itself is still an open resource. We're seeing that with a lot of different curriculum developers. We've got the Gates Foundation as a big funder and lots of different foundations nationwide. And so our state actually has a competitive grant each year that they fund the creation of OER curricula, the development of those. The agreement, if you get one of those grants, is to post it on the OER Commons. There's a huge website called the OER Commons that's national where you can search for curricula. There's not necessarily a lot of quality control there, but OSPI actually has its own site within that site, and all of its curricula have been vetted and have been created through the Washington State OER project. And that sometimes has funded teacher teams from different districts to create curriculum, but sometimes they have also funded curriculum developers from organizations. For example, the Educurious curriculum, which is used in social studies at our middle school level, really cool project-based social studies curriculum. That was originally funded through Washington State's OER grant. And so those units that were created that way will always be free. That's a company that also has additional units that you can purchase. And so that's not unusual too, to see some combination of those things. Free isn't free. Sometimes you think, oh, this is a free curriculum. And yes, the resource itself may be free, but then you usually do have materials and printing and things like that, which can sometimes make it close to the cost of a commercially purchased curriculum. Sometimes there's not a huge difference in the cost. Sometimes there still is a huge difference in the cost. So it just kind of depends from resource to resource what the implementation need will be and what that burden might be on a district. But we're really seeing more and more curricula be developed this way because of the interest of philanthropists in mm-hmm. providing those high quality materials. One term that a lot of our staff are working with right now is the term guaranteed and viable curriculum, or a GVC. And that mm-hmm. was a term coined by Marzano, who's a big educational researcher, who found that if a curriculum is well aligned to the standards and taught with the best instructional practices, so that's the viable part, mm-hmm. and it's a guarantee to all students get it, and it's tightly aligned to the standards, it's taught with inclusionary instructional practices, language practices, highly engaging, that it will meet the needs of about 80% of kids. You'll have 80% of your kids meet the standards with a guaranteed and viable curriculum. So that's a lot of the work that's happening right now with our PLC initiative, is really mm-hmm. starting with our professional learning teams, identifying what are those essential standards, how do we assess them in common ways. Our next step will really be looking at instructional practice. How do we make sure that our practices in the classroom reflect those pieces of our standards now, whether it's an inquiry-based approach in social studies, whether it's a balance of conceptual and procedural in math that allow us to get to that guaranteed and viable curriculum for our kids. I think we've really made a lot of strides in that right now. The resource is kind of the last step of that. We know what we want. We know what we need. We know what kinds of practices a resource needs to support. Now, what are the resources out there that can support that? And more OER resources are a really top contender when we're looking at high quality products. There are risks with the OER because depending on how they're developed and who's hosting them, they can go away. That's also a risk with published curricula. Mm-hmm. Those sunset as well, and they will stop supporting them. We've had situations where with curricula being more and more technology-based and subscription-based, it's no longer that you pay for a batch of materials and you take those back to your room and use them for 10 years. Now, curriculum is almost always some kind of a subscription, and it's accessed online, and it's not unusual at all for after a number of years as a publisher creates a new product to stop supporting the product that you purchased, and you can still use it for a while before you decide to move on to a new one. That is a risk with OER that's also a risk with the publishers.
I want to back up to something you said. You were working on identifying standards, and then you need to move to instructional practices. This is a bit of a bird walk into professional development. I know that that would be the next necessary step. Through professional development, you will be able to help teachers focus on instructional practices. How important is that piece of what you handle in the teaching and learning department?
That is the main thing that we address out of teaching and learning when it comes to professional learning. We know that our teachers want and need, they've told us in surveys, practices for positively supporting behavior in their classrooms, supporting language development and access to content for multilingual learners in their classrooms, supporting social and emotional learning needs in their classrooms, and a strong tier one. You know, I don't know how much our audience knows about multi-tiered systems of support, but that's really how we build our systems now, is the idea that our tier one is our first best instruction for all students. And so a strong tier one curriculum and instruction before we consider interventions incorporates all of those things. Well, that's a tall order. And if you've been in a classroom, and I know you have, been in a classroom where teachers are trying to balance so many things. They're teaching content, but they're also teaching skills. They're teaching language development. They're teaching social and emotional skills as well. And all of these pieces together, that is really sophisticated work that they're doing. You put on top of that maybe a new curriculum adoption, and now I've got even more learning on my plate. That's our responsibility in teaching and learning, to really support people in gaining the skills that they need to teach the kids who are in front of them with the resources that they've selected. That means assessment. What are our assessment practices that are high quality? That means instructional practice. That means using curriculum resources themselves. It's everything that intersects in that world of the curriculum, the instruction, and the assessment. That's kind of where we live in teaching and learning. There's a lot of needs in those areas, including for our newer teachers in the system too, who have an even taller order when it comes to their learning. We have some resources that help us with that. We have a grant from the federal government, actually, each year, our Title II. That is a professional learning grant. It can only be used for professional learning. And so that's the pot of funding that we use when we, for instance, brought in Maria Nielsen this year to work with our elementary teachers around the 15-day challenge and planning their units of instruction really intentionally around their essential standards. It's the pot of money that we use to bring Tom Schimmer to work with our secondary teachers, really looking at the level of rigor reflected in their standards and how they can design common assessments that are designed for the standard and the rigor of the standard, and examine some grading practices and things too. So that, again, those are things our teachers have asked for support with, and that's the funding that we can access to provide those without having an impact on our other district finances, because that money really is only available for that.
I'm glad you pointed it out, because as long as I've been here, this common misconception that if you guys weren't paying to bring these speakers in, you know, you wouldn't be in this situation you're in with your budget. You're mismanaging your money. And maybe there's a belief that if you weren't spending that money, we could repurpose that toward salaries or anything else in the district. And it is PD only. And if we don't use it, it's not able to be repurposed for other expenditures.
Yeah,
it has to be used for this purpose.
Yeah, it can't buy materials for the classroom. It can't buy salaries. It can buy professional learning.
So we would be silly to not get the best professional learning we can with a bucket of money that can only be used for professional learning. I try to talk about this when I'm out, because it just comes up that often that there's really a misnomer about that funding and the PD that we offer and how it's being paid for. So I appreciate you touching on that. I also hear you saying the way you design PD is through a few different mechanisms. It sounds like I hear you talking about surveys. I also know there's a PD committee that gets together to make recommendations, because I have to approve that every year as part of the collective bargaining agreement. Could you expand on the feedback that you get that drives what you decide to offer for professional learning?
We work with the Teachers Association to set priorities for the year, and then we know there are always specific needs. So for example, if we adopt new ELA curriculum at grades 3 through 5, that's a heavy lift for folks, and they're going to need implementation support. They're going to need learning about how does that work? How do I teach this? And so we know that we'll need to plan that as part of our overall professional learning package. So curriculum implementation is always an important part of that. And then you have district initiatives like our PLC work that has had a lot of learning needs associated with it. And that's one thing that we heard from folks was, we all need to hear the same message. We all need to get some of the same learning around this. And that's what led us to bring in Maria and Tom. We meet each year with our association leadership to look at priorities and put out a survey to all the staff. Right now, that survey is live and our staff can rank. We've identified with the association several different potential focuses for professional learning next year. And so they'll rank those in order of importance. Not surprisingly, people want time with their professional learning teams to be looking at student work together, looking at assessment together, planning that instruction together. That's really powerful professional learning. Those cycles of inquiry, that really helps us be data informed. That's really important. We have three different kinds of needs when it comes to PD. We have district needs. You know, we have our district initiatives that are based on our goals and strategic planning. Then there are the buildings. Theirs hopefully are aligned with that, but the buildings each have specific needs of their own. And that's why some of our Fridays are designated as district days and some of our Fridays are designated as building days. And then we also want to make sure that teachers have the ability to drive their own professional learning through their own goals as well, which again, hopefully align to their building and district goals, but they may have some specific things that they're working on. And that's why the teacher-directed Fridays are the bulk of our Fridays, that they can determine what best meets their needs during that time. We seek their input. We also seek their feedback after all of our professional learning events so that we can see what worked well for them, what would make that day or that time more valuable for them. And we really take that seriously in our planning of future days. We've really seen that.
I hear the music playing, which means that we are out of time. Kristen, thank you so much. This has been so enlightening. I hope it helps our listeners to understand a little bit about some of the work that's happening in your department and the thought that goes into the planning for that. Thank you for being here.
Thanks. It's a pleasure.
Thank you for listening today. And remember to join us next week when we continue our conversations about all things education.